I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right, welcome back to another edition of the Friday Golf Podcast. Today, Joseph and I are going to discuss some underrated, under-the-radar Masters storylines. We're going to do our big Masters preview next week. But in the meantime, we figured we would cover a few storylines that might be a little bit smaller, a little flying under the radar, as we are in the last stages of Masters lead up. It's exciting that the first major of the year is here. But first, let's get to in and out. Joseph, what are you in on?
At the risk of being too similar to last week, I'm in on the Valero Texas Open having a better field this year and potentially a little bit better of a weather forecast than in some previous years. This is a place I've always felt like if the field were better, people would have a more favorable opinion of the tournament, and it's often been like 100 degrees. It's a great golf course for testing professional golfers. I'll write more about that for Club TFE, but I think there's a potential that this is going to be a really fun tournament. It's looking like the forecast is going to be in the 70s and in the 80s with some wind, which is a really good way for that golf course to play. So I think people may really enjoy watching this tournament that's been sleepier in the past, but this year we've got Rory, Morikawa, Spieth, Ludwig, Max Homa, Fitzpatrick, like a lot of big names compared to some years previous. So I think it's going to be a great tournament, and I'm pretty fired up about it.
I think an underrated tournament all the time is the week before a major, because you start to see players kind of working it out. And I think you got to play within the 2 weeks before a major. You got to either play the week, you know, like at the Houston, or you got to play this. Just having a pencil and a scorecard in your hand before in the lead up of a major, I think is so important, so that on Thursday you are not just feeling that kind of pressure, uncomfortableness that tournament golf presents you. So I think the week before majors are super underrated. We'll get to my out, which is kind of the opposite, but I do love, I love tournaments the week before majors. You just kind of get to see where players are at. Likewise, like I'm excited to see where Brooks and Rahm are at this week at Live Miami. I think those are the two guys that I'm kind of watching. Maybe you could throw Cam Smith in there also for the Masters, but you know, just to get a check on where these guys' games at heading into the Masters.
I'd probably add Joaquin Niemann to that for me. I mean, I'm pretty interested in seeing where he is entering the Masters as well.
I feel like I've seen a lot from him. I don't necessarily need to see more from him in the lead up. I think I've seen a lot from him this year, you know, in the sense of that. I'm in on Houston and Memorial Park. I think I've been in on them.
Oh, yeah.
I think I've been a champion of them. I thought that this last week, it got the needed spotlight that it deserved the last really 3 years. Since this golf course was reworked by Tom Doak, we have a number of podcast episodes with Tom talking about this project throughout its stages, from the planning to construction to opening of this golf course stages. But I mean, I thought this week it really shined. It obviously, getting out of the fall, getting into this this part of the year where you have this Masters lead up, the attention for golf, the audience for golf is bigger this time of year than it is in the fall. It really shined. And obviously it had a really good field, and I thought it put on a really, really great tournament. So I thought this was I'm super in on Memorial Park as a tournament host, as a golf course. There's a variety of reasons. I thought the design really holds up well to modern golf. It's short grass, low rough, really fascinating greens with small targets that you have to hit in order to score. I think what we saw really, I thought it was highlighted extremely well with the setup on Sunday, was you have to be in the right place to hit an approach close there. And if you're not in the right place, it's going to be hard to make a birdie. And if you try and make a birdie, that's when you bring bogeys or worse into play out there. I thought, you know, listen, like that golf course, along with the Houston market, you're talking about one of the five biggest markets in the country. That golf course in Houston should have a signature event. If you want to talk about building up the PGA Tour, building up the product, this is one of the best combinations of market and golf courses. Maybe, you know, behind Riviera in LA, the best combination of market and golf course that the PGA Tour has. This should be a signature event. It is. They have the opportunity to draw big fans. This is a golf course that anybody can play. It's a tremendous test. I walked away kind of thinking, like, could this sneaky be a PGA championship venue?
I don't think that's crazy. It's an amazing golf course. I think specifically having to miss around the greens in the right spots is something that you don't see that often on the PGA Tour. I mean, it always matters, but it mattered much more at Houston, at Memorial Park, than at a lot of venues. The only part I'd probably disagree with, Andy, I don't think the field was that strong, but the talent within the field elevated to the top, right? It was a compelling leaderboard down the stretch. Obviously, Scottie Scheffler was in the field, but outside of Scheffler,
Scheffler,
there weren't a ton of, like, the Valero Texas Open is going to have a better field. And I totally agree with you that if Memorial had a better field, this could be one of the premier events on the PGA Tour. I'd love to see it as a signature event, especially given the accessibility and the size of the market. But just the golf course in and of itself is worthy of having a signature event. So with all those factors, I'd fully support that it being deemed a signature event.
Hey, I'm going to jump you on my out just because it's going to relate to this conversation.
Go ahead.
I am out on Harbor Town as an elevated event. I love Harbor Town. I love the golf course. I think it's a unique, different test. But I am completely out on signature events after major championships. If I'm the PGA Tour and I want to make these signature events a big deal, the last thing I'm going to do is put them at the week after a major championship, which is going to dwarf them. It is going to make them feel irrelevant. It's going to make them feel small. It's going to make them feel casual in comparison to the Masters or the US Open with the travelers following the US Open. This is just a bad idea. This is not, I know that the players are playing and they're close by, but this is not a good idea. Going from Augusta National to Harbor Town and deeming it one of your premier signature events, like, you're doing multiple things. You're making the signature events feel smaller by putting them next to a major championship. You're also cannibalizing men's pro golf. To me, and I guess, like, where there's a push and pull here is the PGA Tour doesn't own the Masters or the US Open. But to me, the week after the major should be, maybe if you want to still have opposite field events, it should be something like that, or no event. Because a major championship for golf, like, you're still talking about the major championship into Thursday and Friday of the week following a major. The tournament ends on Sunday afternoon, and there's discourse then about the major for at least the next 3 to 4 days. You shouldn't have a big event right after that. There needs to be space, there needs to be time, and that's going to make the sport more popular, is by allowing space, allowing these big events to hold space. And they should be thinking the same thing about signature events. We should have signature events, and then we should have space afterwards for people to talk about our signature events. When you pile these events on top of each other, you are cannibalizing the impact of any of them feeling really big outside of the majors.
I agree, Andy. I'd probably take it a step further, which is even more limiting, but I probably wouldn't want to have a signature event the week before a major either, because
no,
most people's attention is going to be on the major. So yeah, you need to let these breathe. Every time somebody wins a major, it feels like they're going to, it's only a matter of time before they withdraw from that signature event, right? That's directly a week after. Like some of the guys who have
or
still
they,
shown
or
up
they
for
go
it,
and miss
it,
or they go and miss the cut. That's the other option.
Sure.
Right? Like they go there and they shoot one over par over two rounds, or if they make the cut, they finish like it was like John Rahm spent Sunday afternoon in the booth, right? He wins the Masters, and then at Harbortown on Sunday afternoon, he's calling golf because he finished T42 and didn't care. That's the problem, is that nobody cares about the event after the Masters.
I agree. And no one's, I thought the Travelers last year was really sleepy. Obviously, it got a good finish with Keegan Bradley winning, and that was feel good for a lot of people. But I think both Harbortown and Travelers had no energy coming into them and relied on an exciting finish to kind of save the event. Those venues also, frankly, haven't held up particularly well to modern technology. Those are two events that need to be looked at and scrutinized pretty closely, because I think we could get some very low energy tournaments the next couple
years.
Well,
and this is where the Houston thing, right? Like,
yeah.
What are we doing? We're going to Hilton Head Island. I would love to vacation at Hilton Head. I would love to play Harbortown. But is that one of your premier events? Should that be one of your premier events versus Houston, and one of the biggest media markets, opportunity to build out like a lot of stuff around the event because there are millions and millions of people in the metro area,
hotels,
and also a great golf course. So like, to me, like, what are we doing here? This is a market and a golf course worthy of a signature event. Hilton Head Island, like, how many fans can conceivably go to an event there?
Yeah. And again, I think the playability, the golf course is just much better for testing professional golfers at this point, right? That's somewhat preferential, but
I push back there.
I think Harbortown gets a little overrated as a professional golf test.
I think we should have a wide range of different tests, and Harbortown presents a different, unique test. If all the golf courses that host signature events have a similar test, we're going to have a similar skill set of players. I would liken this to different courts in tennis. Some players are better on clay. Some players are better on grass. Some players are better on hard courts. The best players are great at all of the different surfaces. In golf, we should have precision courses. We should have courses that are long and narrow. We should have courses that are kind of open, like open and have like an opportunity to play a lot of angles in. We should have links courses. We should have a really wide range of tests that formulate who the best players are. And over time, if you have a circuit, you're able to begin to say, like, man, that guy is just a links player. We play three signature events a year on links courses. And this guy, just like every year, year in, year out, he makes his hay on links courses. Or, hey, this guy, like Jordan Spieth, plays awesome at Harbortown. You know, why is that?
Look, I agree. I'm not advocating for one type of setup. I just think Harbortown, at this point in its life and where technology has gotten, I think it's compromised that course a lot. I know. I understand. I want a variety of tests. I'm not saying everything should look the same. Pebble Beach is totally different, and I'm fully support it being a signature event. I'm not saying every golf course should look like Riviera or Memorial Park, but I just, in general, I tend to think that we've overrated Harbortown a little bit in the test that it presents. But
I think there is like an aspect of the history of Harbortown and sure, what that golf course meant for golf design, that, you know, the launching of Pete Dye's like mainstream appeal as a golf architect, that does put it into a stratosphere that, you know, I think there's significance to the history behind it. And I agree with that. Like, where my problem with Harbortown as a signature event more lies with where it is, a like sleepy resort, and B, where it is on the schedule the week after a major, which it has no hope of ever having any juice.
Agree. And I think something we can probably agree on, the as you're talking about Harbor Town's legacy and its history, going back to Pete Dye's early coming onto the scene, legacy and technology are working against one another right now. And the PGA Tour needs to realize that if they want to tout legacy and they want to play on some historic courses, having the game at the right scale is more conducive to that than just letting it grow out of control. So I think we can probably agree on that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a great point, too. I agree with that point.
What I'm out on, I'm going to pivot and kind of piggyback off of you a little bit. Something I've bounced around in my head a lot, I think where I've landed, I'm out on major championships getting FedEx Cup points. And I think there's a good case to be made either way here, but I think I've pretty much landed on giving FedEx Cup points, distributing them at major championships, is kind of an admission from the PGA Tour that their events will always play second fiddle to major championships, because the season-long race, let's say a player won three majors and didn't even qualify for East Lake, let's just say, because you weren't giving points at majors, people would say, well, this doesn't feel like the season-long race. Like, you don't even have this player who had the best season. But I think that's kind of the point. If you want to build a special season-long race, like, these aren't PGA Tour events, the major championships. It's not, I think the entanglement between majors and the PGA Tour, obviously a hot topic between OWGR and a million issues you can get into in which the game is too tangled, coupled between the PGA Tour and the majors. I think this is another example where the PGA Tour could elevate its product by actually removing its scoring system, decoupling it from majors. Where do you land on that?
It's an interesting idea. And I think, like, there's always been this thing of, like, you know, for years, it's like you get 50 extra points if you win a major. Like, there's no way to actually accurately represent the majors in the FedEx Cup, because if you accurately represented what a major championship wins in terms of points, it would make all of your other events look silly. I agree. This is not a PGA Tour event. It's set up by other people. It's not a PGA Tour event. They get a fraction of revenue from it. I kind of agree. That being said, I think it could go two ways. I think when you make decisions and changes, there's lots of unintended consequences. And I think, like, you could, there's a vacuum where you could conceivably see this elevating the PGA Tour events. But I think there's also a vacuum that could make people care less about FedEx Cup points. And you laid it out, like, and the part of this live creates this too, but let's just say let's say Matt Fitzpatrick wins two majors this year but does nothing in PGA Tour events. It would make the PGA Tour look really silly if he, like, didn't make it to East Lake. But as you said, that's a different, you could go both ways on this. I think that's the thing. It would be an extraordinary risk. And I don't know if a multi-billion-dollar organization can feasibly accept that type of risk. I am all for shaking things up. This seems like a huge step. And I don't necessarily, you know, listen, I like the idea, that I think there are positives to the idea.
Yeah, that's where I've landed. I've thought about it a lot. I think you are admitting by not doing it that your events are way inferior to major championships. And if East Lake is special and guys have done well in majors but haven't done well in any of the PGA Tour events, like, if it matters to them, then he needs to play better in PGA Tour events to qualify for the PGA Tour season end race. Majors aren't PGA Tour events. So I think I've landed on being out on them giving points, but I understand it's not that easy.
I think the other thing looming with everything going on in men's pro golf is that the players, really the PGA Tour players who are standing in the way of really getting the game back together. And I think Liv's standing in the way of getting the game back together too, but they need to understand they're all getting equity in the PGA Tour. If you have all the best players back together, I think that's actually bad news for the major championships. I think the current setup of golf is extraordinarily beneficial to the majors.
Oh yeah.
If all the players are together, they can begin to negotiate with major championships about their revenue shares, which with these championships produce the most revenue of any events on the annual golf calendar. And I mean, in terms of revenue splits, the players get very little of it. If they're all together and they're all equity holders of this entity, they can begin to negotiate against it because the majors need the players. They have to have the top players in the game. As long as it's split, they're going to have they have no negotiating power. So I just think that in terms of the players, if the tour has so much more opportunity to begin to elevate its events if all the players are together.
I didn't know we were going here today, but if you're hinting at maybe some of the reason that the official world golf rankings have been hesitant to give points to Liv being kind of protecting the status quo, if you're suggesting that, it is something I agree with. So that is I feel like that's kind of an elephant in the room to an extent. Like, how malicious or nefarious do you think some of those actors are being versus just protecting the integrity of the system? I do think there's a case to be made that they're a little bit worried about some of the gained leverage that players would have all being together and actually trying to get a bigger share of the revenue. So I didn't know we were going there today, but that is something I have felt.
If I'm Augusta National, I want nothing to change with my current arrangement with the best male professional golfers, because I give them a very small percentage of the revenue I generate on a week, and I generate a ton of revenue that I am able to use every year to make enhancements that make us more money the next year, and the more money the next 10 years. And I think like there is a little bit of an undercurrent of, you know, listen, the USGA, the US Open funds a lot of what the USGA does. The PGA Championship and the Ryder Cup fund a lot of what the PGA Championship and the PGA of America does. The Open funds, you know, the players get very little of that money in comparison to the way other sports leagues operate. And that's just in the only way that would change in the long term is if all the players are together.
And you know what the best representation of some of those ideas in practice is? That within the official world golf rankings, you get 100 points fixed for winning a major championship. And the players' championship is fixed at 80 and capped at 80. The reason for that, I don't think you have to read too far into it, is that if it were actually just based on field strength, the players would outrate some of these major championships, like the Masters. But through the official world golf rankings, they've decided to fix the majors at 100 and cap the players at 80. I think that is you don't have to be too conspiratorial brained to understand why that's beneficial to the governing bodies and to maybe make one more leap that the official world golf rankings is kind of a mechanism of retaining the status quo. So I didn't know we were going there today, but I like that.
All right. Before we get into our Masters storylines, a huge announcement from Friday Golf and Shotgun Start. The coffee is back. We used to do a coffee subscription years ago through a company called Bixby. Bixby sold their business, and since then we haven't had a coffee partner to create this co-branded coffee. That is no more. We are back in the coffee business thanks to Good Walk Coffee Company. Their founder, Chris, is an absolute golf nut. It is a coffee company that's focused on like coffee for golfers. And I'm extremely excited. Joseph, are you a coffee drinker?
Big time. I mean, I just keep it simple with Starbucks every day, but I drink coffee every day.
Oh, man. We got to get that changed. We got to get you on the product. So we have two blends, really trying to appeal to all types of coffee drinkers. We've got the fried egg blend, which is kind of going to be on your more medium light blend. It's a Papua New Guinea coffee. As well as a darker blend. It's going to be kind of more on the medium dark side. They're both great. So depending on how you like your coffee, we've got two different blends for you. The Shotgun Start is the medium dark blend. The Fried Egg blend is the medium light blend. We'll probably dive in with some more special blends around events and different things. Like I expect a holiday blend. But if you want to purchase our coffee, it obviously goes to support us as well as Good Walk. It is at goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg. That's goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg, and you can shop there. You can subscribe. This is the way I do it. There's nothing better than never having to worry about whether or not you're going to have coffee, never having like that morning where you're like, I don't have any coffee. I'm going to have to run out. So subscribe. That's the easiest way. Obviously, goes a long way to support us and the products that we're creating. So, and it's delicious coffee. It's a great consumable good that we went and tried probably, I think I tried like 10 different coffees, to pick out which ones me and Brendan, and Cameron, for that matter, to pick out which one we wanted, to give to you guys. So, check that out. It's goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg. Subscribe, and it saves you money, and it gets you just coffee all the time. So big thanks to Good Walk, and excited for this long-term partnership with them. All right, Joseph, let's get into our underrated, under-talked about sleeper storylines for the Masters. Give me your first one.
Andy, I don't want to be too harsh with this one, but I do think there is a very good professional golfer who people think very highly of his game and needs to do something in major championships before being crowned elite. I mean, or even very good. Sam Burns is playing excellent golf this year. He is, I believe he had four straight top tens. Earlier in the year, coming off a couple finishes that aren't as strong, but he's shown some serious form. He's played 14 majors in his career. He has one top 20. He tied for 20th in the 2022 PGA Championship. Outside of that, no top 20s. I think sometimes you see that with these golfers who are really good with a wedge and a putter, that when they get moved to a more demanding major championship like setup, it's longer, more long irons and short game. They don't have the same results. You're not at PGA West anymore. He's kind of the anti-Cam Young, where Cam Young's not as good with the wedge and the putter, but much better with hitting the driver a little straighter, just a better overall ball striker with some of the long game. He's done exceptionally well in his young major career so far. I want to see some more of that from Sam Burns. I think this Masters
Zalatoris would be another great example of the opposite of Burns.
Sure. Same with Hideki Matsuyama, right? Like there's multiple examples you could throw out there. Like that's, again, a big part of why I advocated so much for Cam Young over Sam Burns last year at the Ryder Cup, because Marco Simone was a little bit more of a major championship like setup with long irons. We need to see something from Sam Burns. Don't want to be too critical, but we're starting to accrue a big enough sample size that if he wants to be considered a great golfer, he needs to do something. This year is a prime time to do it. So that's an underrated storyline for me.
All right, I'm going to go along the same lines. I echo your Sam Burns. I'm going to go with a guy that's had a lot of major championship success, but has been in a bit of a lull. And like as he's aging into his later 20s, I think there's a big question of have we seen the best of this player? Colin Morikawa.
Okay.
Obviously, he's got two major championships, but that was a long time ago. We're now bordering on 4 years ago for those major championships. And, you know, we haven't seen him really win a lot. He won the Zozo in the fall. He hasn't won an event in like the regular the season for golf, non-fall event since the Open in 2021. So my question, you know, is kind of centers around, you know, what is Colin Morikawa, an elite top 10 talent? Is he one of the 10 best players in the game? Or is he just kind of like another really good professional golfer? And I think 3 years ago, he was without a doubt, oh, this guy might be the next great player. And I think now that's a big question. And I think this major season, the Masters in particular, I think is a really good course fit. He's played well here. We haven't seen him contend in a major since the Masters in 2022. So what is Colin Morikawa's kind of like major championship future? Is he a guy that's going to get to 4-5 majors, or is it kind of two and done?
I think that's completely fair. Colin Morikawa's been a little bit frustrating over the past couple of years, where he disappears at times when you think he's going to play great golf, and then he pops up and wins the Zozo by multiple shots, and you're like, well, where's that been in big golf tournaments? So I agree, Colin Morikawa does need to show it. Yeah, he's coming out. He's played 4 majors, 3 top 20s. He needs to get in the mix in one of these. I'm with you.
Yeah, and like that fifth at the Masters in 2022 was a very non-competitive fifth, right?
Yeah, he needs to get in the mix.
Him and Rory played like they were never really in it. And they both played. They had great Sundays and got like great finishes, but they weren't really in the tournament. You didn't think, oh, that guy's going to win.
And frankly, Morikawa hasn't done a whole lot so far this calendar year. So I think it's an open question of where his game is right now.
I mean, he hasn't done much the last 2 years outside of that Zozo.
Yeah. He almost won Rocket Mortgage last year. He was in the playoff. And then, I mean, he was kind of in the mix at Torrey. And then he kind of threw away the tournament at Kapalua.
Yeah.
But that's not a lot of contention. And those aren't the most high profile events either. So it's time to see Colin Morikawa on a big stage again.
You saw him at Kapalua last year and you're like, oh, this is going to be a big year. Like yeah. It looked like he was running away with that event. It's like, oh, Morikawa, this is it. And I just wonder what is he at this point? Is he a superstar or is he an above average PGA Tour player? And I think that's a real question.
I think what stands out to me, Andy, watching him, this is a random tournament to pull, but when he won the WGC Workday at Concession, that was a pretty cool golf tournament, and he looked so good. Then he wins the Open a few months later. Like, we haven't seen that Colin Morikawa in quite some time.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and I think that, listen, like, this is one of the things that is hard, is like, when you reach a different level of star, you have less time to be who made you the star. And I think if you look at Morikawa, he has more off the course responsibilities than he ever had when he was a young player, when he was a standout, unbelievable college player. When you win 2 majors before the age of what, 26, you all of a sudden enter the stratosphere, and I you know, I wonder, you know, it's just one of those things, like is the work the same amount of work being put in that used to be put in? And I think that's, I don't know, I have no clue about that, but I do know that there are more demands on his time than ever before in his life.
Yeah, I guess for me with Colin, it's, I think the only concern, I mean, I think very highly of his game. He has multiple things at any given point that could come and bite him. Like, he's not the longest off the tee. He hits it dead straight, but he's not the longest. His short game isn't always solid, and the putting can be hit or miss. So when you have multiple parts of your game that can be a concern in any given week, it's hard to project him to win. Like, he's not on, nobody's on Scotty's level, but he's multiple steps from being on Scotty's level. And I think especially with the lack of pop off the tee on some of these more demanding golf courses, his iron play has to be unbelievable to cover up some potential short game deficiencies. So you're asking, he needs to really be on.
He's always going to be compared to Hovland and Matt Wolf. And I think Matt Wolf for this this discussion has kind of removed himself from the discussion. But with Hovland, I think that's like it's an interesting comparison because Hovland, you know, you're getting elite tee to approaching the green play week in, week out. The putter, I think, is more reliable for Hovland. And the short game has gotten to a respectable level. Like, I think when you look at the true superstars, they have always, almost always have three very, very dependable skills. And usually there's one flaw. And with Morikawa, I think what you've illuminated on is the lack of pop and the putting can both be problems.
The short game can be a problem too. I mean, it's not always, I wouldn't call his short game rock solid. It's certainly not elite. And frankly, we're seeing that with Hovland, a resurgence in the short game last year. And then this year, it's kind of regressed back to a little bit of a questionable level. So that may be another underrated storyline, maybe not so underrated. So I won't use that one up.
Yeah. I think Victor Hovland falls into the top tier storylines for me. I didn't want to, but I think he'll always be, him and Morikawa will always be compared because they turn pro at the same time, I think.
All right, should I get to my second storyline?
Yeah.
I think for me, always at Augusta, somebody you just have to pay attention to, Patrick Reed. And why I think he's particularly...
He hasn't been very good this year.
He hasn't, but it's never really mattered too much, his form, to when he shows up to the Masters. T4 last year, T35 the year before, wasn't great. T8, T10, T36, and then a win, obviously, in 2018. So he can play in the Masters the rest of his playing career. He's not qualified, though, Andy, for any other majors this year. And he's outside the top 100 in the official world golf rankings with limited access as a live player to getting those official world golf rankings points. So, I mean, for Patrick Reed, this Masters isn't just an opportunity to add to his legacy with potentially winning another one or registering another top finish, but it's also a much needed scarce opportunity to get some of those official world golf rankings points or finish highly enough to qualify for some of the majors the rest of the year. It's a really big golf tournament for him specifically and an amazing course fit. So I think Patrick Reed's a really compelling story to watch. I never doubt him at this place.
I mean, in a way, the Masters is probably the best place to qualify for other majors for any of the LIV players in the field that are not qualified for the other majors.
Why do you say that?
It's a small field. And if you finish high in this event with a small field that out the older players and, you know, some of the past champions, some of the other exemptions, like, you know, you have like the Latin American AM qualifier, you take out those players and it becomes a very small field with a lot of different qualifications that are at stake. And, you know, you in any tournament, you immediately can shrink the field of players you're competing against because half the field is not going to play well. That is like just math. And in this case, you have probably about 20 or 15 players that shouldn't really be that are there because of past success. Or, you know, so you take like an high 80s, 90 player field and you have removed it down to like a 25 player tournament if you're on your game. And then, you know, so then you all of a sudden the qualification standpoint, like, what is it, top 12 gets in next year's Masters? And then I think it's, I can't remember what the exact thing is for the US Open. But, you know, if you're playing well and you're one of the players that, you know, that is in their prime, it is not an unreasonable thing to use the Masters to qualify for the other three majors.
Right. And you could just do it on points alone, right? You could finish second and get a bunch of official world golf rankings points and jump up a bunch of slots. Like, there's so many points at stake at a major championship that you can really move your way up. So again, Patrick Reed, even when he doesn't play that well, finds himself doing pretty well at this golf tournament. If he shows up with a little bit of game, like that's somebody who could finish in the top five. I'm excited to watch him. He plays obviously a creative style of golf, and I'm just excited to watch him play here, especially with what's at stake.
All right. This is almost like always something that I think about. And I think we had like a real breakthrough this year with Nick Dunlap winning the Amex. But the idea of a young player, an amateur that potentially contends on Sunday to win the Masters. I think this is, you know, something that we've seen. Obviously, Sam Bennett was a player that contended pretty deep into the tournament. But this year, you know, you have a number of young players. Christo Lamprecht is one to keep an eye on. The guy's got a lot of game. We saw him leading the Open last year. You've got Dunlap, obviously, in there. I'm just throwing Ludwig in here because he's, you know, last year he was in college at this time. He's going to be a first timer. I think there's a real chance that we see one of these young players. Neil Shipley is another name, finished runner up at the USAM to Dunlap. So these are the players kind of to watch. And I think it's a matter of time. I thought, you know, 5 years ago, we were going to see an amateur win a PGA Tour event. We saw that this year. I don't think it's unrealistic to think the way the game is going, the talent in the young ranks, to see an amateur contend late or even potentially win a major championship at some point in the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Open that Bo Hostler contended in, that's still a fond memory for me of a major championship in the past 15 years. Like, he was in contention pretty late. I mean, he was final group, right?
I think that was like Saturday. Then he kind of fell out. I think, yeah, if I remember correctly. Another one would be Paul Dunn and Jordan Niebrugge in the Open. Maybe 2015 that was, or 2016. They played really well. I think Niebrugge finished T6.
So it can happen. I think the one you got to keep in mind with the Masters, it's a pretty low variance tournament that elevates talent in a way that's much more difficult for a long shot to compete. So of all the four majors, I'd probably say the Masters is the least likely spot for that. Definitely say that.
Well,
but
the PGA is the least likely because they don't have amateurs in it.
Well, okay. If you're specifically using the amateur designation, that's fair. I thought you're talking any young Ludwig first timers, but sure.
Yeah.
That's fair. But yes, long shots are going to have a tough time at the Masters. So that'd be the one caveat, but I'd love to see it. Any in particular that you think?
I think Christo Lamprecht is one to watch. I don't know exactly how he's played this year in college golf, but the guy is a stud. He's got huge, tons of speed. Plays at Georgia Tech. He won the British Am last year. He's 6'8". He absolutely mashes the ball, and I just think he's got a ton of game. He's felt what it's like. He went at Liverpool. I think he shot 66 or 65 in the opening round. And listen, like, the guy's now knows what it's like to be, you know, on the leaderboard in a major championship. And I think, like, he's got a ton of game. So he'd be my, I think he's the overwhelming low am, belief, but I think you throw Dunlap in there and I think, like, listen, like, Ludwig being a first timer and a year removed from college is kind of an interesting storyline. He wouldn't be on my big storylines, but he's an interesting, like, how's this guy's in the top 10, he's playing his first Masters at age 23.
Yeah, and again, this will be another bigger storyline, but Wyndham Clark's never played a Masters either, which is crazy to think about. So
he's what, 3 and 4 in the world now?
Yeah, so that might be jumping the gun on big storylines, but just in terms of first timers.
First timer, the biggest story is Peter Malnati.
Yeah, how do you like Malnati's chances?
Don't love him. How about you?
All right, should I go to my third one?
Yeah, go for it.
My third one is kind of, again, related to some of the conversation we've already had about the, for better or for worse, importance of the official world golf rankings, whether you like them or not. Olympic/President's Cup qualifying. A lot of points are at stake in the major championships, as we've already mentioned multiple times in this podcast. And the Olympics is just something that nobody ever really mentions, that that's so close from here. And the way you qualify is via the official world golf rankings. So if you want to be, if you want to be competing in this year's Olympics at Le Golf National, you're going to have to do well in the majors, especially if you're on LIV, right? Like that's your only way that you can get in. So I think that that's a interesting storyline. The President's Cup Part 2, obviously without LIV golfers there, it's may not be competitive and that event may not have as much juice as it should have. But I, who knows, Andy? I don't know where you are on the Olympics, if you think it has potential to be special, but this is how you get in. So pretty big. The Masters is a pretty big opportunity for some of those hopefuls.
I mean, talk about something that is a huge, huge event in terms of like the greater sports world. The everybody loves to throw around Grow the Game. I don't know if there is an event that has more opportunity to garner new fans than the Olympics, because it's the Olympics and like people can just pass by golf. Like I don't think there's another. Is there another golf event that has that like passerby potential?
Probably not. I'm trying to think. Maybe if you're walking around St. Andrews and there's an Open Championship going on, but that doesn't really count.
Yeah. So you've got this like unbelievable passerby opportunity and nobody ever talks about it in golf. We don't even know. Like, it seems to me like it feels like players, the top players are just trying to figure out excuses on why they don't need to play the event.
Yeah.
That's been the history of the Olympics. And golf is like, how do I get out of this? Nobody's asking questions to the players like, hey, Rory, are you going to play in the Olympics this year? Because I think that's a big question. I don't even know, if, you know, like with what the Olympics does to the golf schedule, we've seen it, like it puts the golf schedule kind of in shambles. So I don't know who's going to even play in the Olympics this year. I mean, the South Africa is one of the great golf countries. All the best South Africans, for the most part, are playing on LIV. They aren't getting world golf ranking points. So are any of them going to be in it?
I don't think so, because I don't think they're going to qualify. Because they're not. It's not. I mean, it's based on your official world golf rankings until you hit 60 players that fill out the field. And it caps. It basically caps at 2 per country. There can be 4 if you're all in the top 15. But after that,
so that's the U.S. The U.S. gets 4 and that's it.
Right, exactly. But I don't, you're not going to, you'll get to 60 before you'll hit South Africans unless they play super well in the majors. And the cutoff is after the US Open. So they're not even going to get the chance in the Open Championship to rack up any points. So it's a little bit of a funky, yeah, I agree with you. We're just not talking about it at all. Some players have already voiced that they don't want to play. We'll see. I don't know who's going to be playing in that. Who's going to be the 55th golfer?
I mean, the nice thing is that you have like a lot of talent, a lot of depth in some new countries, some different countries. And I think that's I think the Olympics, golf in the Olympics will hit, you know, its ultimate potential when you see somebody from a non-typical non-golf country win a gold medal.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
China, India.
I was thinking Toasty. I don't know how kind Le Golf National would be to Toasty, but he's got a chance of qualifying.
The Toast Man.
Have you thought about him in an Olympic uniform?
I mean, him in the Olympic Village would be just amazing.
Amazing. It's not far-fetched. I mean, Griot's going to qualify before Toasty would, but I mean, if he has a good next couple of months, he's not qualified for the Masters, but it's not out of the realm of possibilities that Toasty could qualify.
I mean, that's like the neat thing when you start to like, I mean, Joaquin Niemann in Chile, you know, Toasty there, there are a lot of like exciting different countries. I always think about Belgium in this, like, and that's kind of, I think, where the Olympics has dropped the ball. I saw that they announced they're going to do the mixed competition. The other aspect of it is the team competition. Give these, like, if Belgium beats America or the U.S. in golf for a gold medal, and like, this is something that could happen. conceivably happen. They have three very good tour pros in Dietrich, Adrian Dumont de Chassart, and Peters. It is not inconceivable for them to beat the U.S. team. If you do that, it would have a massive impact on that country. South Korea. Same goes for like Argentina. If Toasty and Griot beat the U.S., like, that's an unbelievable story. It's not inconceivable for even like some of these countries for the 400th ranked player in the world to play at a high level and beat the 20th ranked player in the world. That's the difference between, like, it's taken basketball decades for these other countries to compete with the U.S. that has such a dominant amount of talent. But we're getting to the point where it is a really good tournament. The U.S. is still the favorite, but there's a conceivable pass that the U.S. doesn't win. They have to play really well to win. They have to play well to win, and they have to have their best players playing. With golf, not having the team competition is the biggest miss, and I think it's been hit on so many times and talked about so many times. But it's really hard to galvanize fans around individuals compared to galvanizing fans around a team represented by your country in the Olympics. I mean, this is a layup.
I agree. And I hadn't really thought about this, but as I'm thinking about it now, I kind of hate that there can be four from one particular country if they're in the top 15. Like, that kind of ruins it a little bit for me as I'm thinking through it. Like, it would be kind of nice to just have all two-person teams so you could compare apples to apples a little bit more. Here's how this country did. Here's how this country did. I understand getting more star power into the field, but especially when it doesn't mean that much to a lot of these golfers, unfortunately, I kind of wish it was just two per country.
I think it would be really cool if you had an individual tournament, a stroke play tournament, and then there was, and it could be 36 holes or whatever, and then there was a match play component for countries that had three, that you could qualify three people. You expand the field from 60 to maybe it's 100, and all the countries that qualify three players are in the team tournament. And the team tournament then goes to match play with the top four or eight teams. And there's three or two rounds of match play. And there you get your winner with three players.
I'm down for that. Also, the mixed.
Think about Canada. Think about Canada would have a team, you know,
the mixed idea that they're throwing around for the 2028 Olympics, where it'd be, you know, maybe two men from a team and two women. Like, that also is a pretty cool format for this. So I'd be in on that.
Yeah. So anyways, that should be, I didn't expect our Masters pod to devolve into Olympics chatter, but that's it. The last thing I have is Jason Day.
All right.
Jason Day to me is just an interesting, he's still playing golf at a high level. And I think he is one of the great Masters players. We've seen this, like, players that have incredible Masters record that just never get the win. To me, also, Jason Day, when you think about his career, his legacy, it doesn't feel like one major is enough for his career, for who he was. I think he's constantly, like, for 18 months of his career, he was by far the best player in the world, and he was extraordinarily great in months that he wasn't the best player in the world. Here's his Masters record. 2011, first Masters T2, 2012 WD, 2013 third, 2014 T20, 2015 T28, 2016 T10, 22nd, 2017 20th, in 2018, 2019 T5. Obviously then 2020, 2021 were where he kind of had his troubles in his career with the injuries. Cut. T39 last year doesn't tell the story. He was cruising early in that tournament, and then he got vertigo. He was the only guy that was going to catch Koepka on Friday, and then he gets hit with vertigo. I think this guy, the Masters represents his best opportunity to win a major. We always see these kind of players that win a major late in their career that's like kind of that icing on the cake. He's about the same age as when Sergio won his Masters. And I just think Jason Day should get to two majors in his career.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was thinking a lot this weekend about the difference between one and two majors is just absolutely massive. Like, one can happen. Like, that can be kind of fluky. But the list of people who has two, like, that's a much more established, impressive list where you really feel like you've solidified your career. I agree. Jason Day feels of the caliber to notch that second major championship. And I think especially last year, he was playing such good golf entering the Masters. He was coming off a good finish at Dell Match Play, like had played, I think, all top 20s between Amex and Match Play, which was seven events entering the Masters. And then we didn't really see that much from Jason Day the rest of the year. He won at Byron Nelson, finished T2 at Liverpool, obviously a strong finish, but since then he's really been hit or miss. I'd love to see Jason Day in contention.
Do you know how many second place finishes in majors he has?
I don't. How many does he have?
Five.
That's tough. Yeah.
That's like, you know, the sliding doors of major golf is there's only one winner. And a lot of people that come close. And, so he's got 11 top fives on top five major finishes in his career. Obviously he has similar players too.
Not to throw a fourth one, but, another player who the reason I was thinking about this, I think he'll go down as maybe one of the most underrated players of the last two decades. One major championship, doesn't feel like enough. Great fit here. Justin Rose. I mean, it is crazy to me that Justin Rose could finish his career with just one major, and that doesn't feel like it should be that way.
This is their kind of last few years. I think like you get into these, especially now, it used to be 40s, but I think golf's kind of shifted. These are two players that are in their late 30s and it's, you know, they might have a couple more spins around here. I think Jason Day, you know, he's had a decent year. He's got three top 10s on the year. I think he's somebody to watch.
Rose is 43, but yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, all right, that does it for me. You got any parting thoughts on that?
No, it's going to be an amazing tournament. I think we'll get some more storylines as the Valero Texas Open and as Doral unfolds. Like, there will probably be some storylines entering there. So, just excited for the tournament.
All right, do you have a recommendation?
Can I give one that's completely random, Andy?
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this documentary I watched a while ago called Bill Cunningham, New York. Do you know who Bill Cunningham is, Andy?
I do not.
It's a famous photographer, and there's an awesome HBO documentary about him doing his job in his daily life, and he's just infatuated with taking pictures of fashion that he sees in everyday life. Never was wealthy, never cared about money, lived in like a tiny apartment, was super well-connected because of all the people that wanted him to photograph them. Famous New York Times photographer, extremely refreshing watch about somebody that's just fully invested in what they like to do. I think it has mass appeal. I watched it with my mom. You can watch it with your significant other, however you want to watch it. I think most people would like it. Just a little bit different, totally non-sports, but that documentary has really stuck with me.
Great, great recommendation. My recommendation, this is kind of like a part ad, but we have all of our events as of Tuesday. So the most likely day you're listening to this podcast are launched and available. So Friday Egg events, we've got some amazing venues. You know, a couple I'll highlight: Hollywood Golf Club, one of the best courses that very few people talk about. Walter Travis design, absolutely mesmerizing greens. That's one to look at. Chambers Bay. We are hosting a tournament the day after the Pacific Coast Amateur. It will be in the best shape that Chambers Bay will be in all year. It is also, I think, from what I've heard from locals, a very good deal in terms of pricing for two rounds at Chambers Bay. That's in the middle of the summer in Seattle. I haven't been there. I'm excited. I think I'm going to try and go to that one. I haven't been to Seattle. I really want to go to Seattle. So that's one that I would highlight. And then two other ones, Essex County, one of the best Donald Ross courses in the world, and Prairie Dunes, one of the best golf courses, period, in the world. So those are a few that I'll highlight. You can check them all out at proshop.thefriedegg.com. All of our events are there. So come out, hang out. They are a great time. Really, like, the whole ethos of Fried Egg events is, like, they're built around, like, how would you want to have a day of golf at a really great golf course? It's all about the golf. It's, you know, we play, it's fun. You meet really cool people, other people that are really into golf. I think that's, you know, that's what people are there to do. And yeah, they're a great time. I know you've attended a few as a patron before you worked here.
Amazing. Yeah. Of the ones you mentioned, I've played two of them as part of Fried Egg events. The Hollywood Golf Club, the Walter Travis in Deal, New Jersey, and then Essex County Club in Manchester by the Sea. Those were two unbelievable days of golf. So I cannot recommend those enough, and I'm sure the other ones are just as good.
Yeah, we have them all over the country. So if you're trying to stay regional, you can do that. Or if you're trying to travel somewhere, I would, you know, like, I think the Seattle one, the Chambers Bay one's a great one to do, like, a weekend away. So, all right. Big thanks. And thanks to Matt Ruches for editing and producing this podcast. We will be back. I'm excited about the next podcast. I have it. I have the file. I'm going to devour it probably before it goes up. But Garrett is back with his Great Courses series. And the topic is Augusta National. He has a great guest, Josh Pettit, who put together the marvelous Mackenzie Reader book. He's previously been on the podcast to talk about Mackenzie, but they go deep on Augusta National, the latest in the Great Courses series, which previously has documented the Old Course, Sunningdale, Royal Melbourne, and am I forgetting one? National Golf Links of America. So those are the previous four episodes. If you haven't, those are amazing. Garrett's done an amazing job with those episodes. I cannot wait to listen to the Augusta National one. But yeah, that's what we have. And next, you know, next time we do this pod, it'll be Masters Week. So big thanks to Matt for producing all this stuff, and excited for the next kind of 2 weeks here.